Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
Let us reinvestigate the fingerprints of intelligence all over Lee Harvey Oswald from 1959 to 1960, his violent death in 1963. And most importantly, this CIA, whose muddy footprints are all over this case. A true interrogation.
That was film director Oliver Stone testifying before a House committee Tuesday on newly declassified documents about the Kennedy assassination, arguing that the new material backs up the idea that the late president was gunned down by a conspiracy orchestrated by the CIA. Stone has been beating this horse for years, ever since his 1991 film, JFK, a highly manipulative piece of agitprop that glorified the exploits of a crackpot New Orleans prosecutor, James Garrison, who claimed to have proven the agency's role in the murder, only to have his case fall apart in court, with his sole defendant, a local businessman named Clay Shaw, acquitted by a jury in less than an hour. Stone's film did lead to legislation requiring the release of all government documents about the assassination, a process that has dragged on for years, prompting President Trump to finally order the remaining redacted material to be produced this month. But what do the documents actually show, if anything, about the Kennedy assassination? And more importantly, what does it say about the state of our politics and our addiction to conspiracy theories that we are even still talking about this? We'll discuss with Fred Lippmann, the author of multiple books debunking Kennedy assassination conspiracy theories, and Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive, a research group dedicated to government transparency, on this episode of Spy Talk. All right, we are going to break with tradition a little bit for this episode of Spy Talk. We have two guests, Fred Lippmann, avid student of Kennedy conspiracy theories, and Peter Kornbluh, a avid student of CIA covert operations. So, Fred and Peter, welcome to Spy Talk.
Great. Thank you for having us.
So let's start out with this remarkable hearing in the House on Tuesday, chaired by Congresswoman Luna, a Republican from Florida, MAGA enthusiast. I should point out, just to sort of set the stage of where she's coming from, she recently introduced legislation to add Donald Trump's face to Mount Rushmore, which gives you some idea of her political, where she is politically at the moment. And in her opening statements, talking about the newly released JFK assassination files, she said, the revelations emerging from these files is nothing short of staggering. Fred, what do you make of that?
Well, I clearly Congresswoman Luna really doesn't understand the JFK case, and that's quite unfortunate. And so she has been taken in by people like Jefferson Morley, who are spinning tales from these documents. He's seeing things. He's seeing patterns that just aren't there. And she's been taken in by that. And the rest of her committee, the whole thing was just crazy because the whole committee doesn't understand the JFK case, and nobody was able to ask decent questions yesterday.
Peter, staggering revelations on the Kennedy assassination?
Well, wait, you have to divide that question. There are smoking guns in these documents, but they're about the history of CIA covert operations around the world, not about the Kennedy assassination.
That's true.
People do not understand how these other documents on CIA covert operations in Italy and Chile and Mexico, you know, et cetera, got into a collection that's supposed to be about the Kennedy assassination. And that takes a lot of time to explain, but it's very important. And these documents literally have the final secrets that the CIA has tried to safeguard for decades, never wanted to let out, and never would have allowed to be declassified for eternity had not we had this JFK Assassinations Record Act that basically mandated that all these final secrets be released.
And I want to talk about some of those secrets, but I want to start out with what the hearing was about, which was the Kennedy assassination. And Peter, just to put a fine point on this, have you seen any revelations that have moved the needle or shed any light on the Kennedy assassination itself?
There are none that we have seen. And I would go way out on a limb and predict there will be none in the end. And those of us like Fred and myself and others never expected to see any such revelations on the actual Kennedy assassination. Because for one thing, many of these documents have been released before in almost unredacted form. And so we've had them, and none of them have shed any light on or changed the narrative as we understand it and know it, that Lee Harvey Oswald, acting on his own, shot the president on November 22nd, 1963 in Dallas, Texas.
I think what Jefferson Morley has been doing is a good example is he's taken one FBI document. This is an FBI document where they found out about HT-Lingual. This was the program to intercept mail between the Soviet Union and the United States. The FBI finds out about it. They go to talk to James Angleton, and this is an FBI document with they're reporting what Angleton is telling them. And he says, well, you know, the main reason we're doing this is to develop some sources and contacts in the Soviet Union. And so they report that back. And so Morley thinks, oh, my God, that was the reason why they added Oswald to the list because they wanted him as a contact, which is wrong. There were other reasons why the CIA did this program. And of course, because Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, he was added to the watch list. And Morley has this belief that the CIA was surveying Oswald when in fact Oswald was always brushing up against American intelligence. So they weren't reading Oswald's mail, but Oswald's mail was being intercepted by this program. And in fact, the program only intercepted one letter from his mother to Oswald and the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I was amused by that in reading over the dossier, which Morley several times held up at the hearing, suggesting it was an important document that had significant revelations. The letter, the one letter that was intercepted, is a letter from Oswald's mother to Oswald while he's in the Soviet Union, telling him she's going to be sending him a parcel and asking him to write more frequently to her.
That's right.
Yes. So the CIA discovered that a mother wanted to hear more, read more letters from her son.
There's another document in the dossier that's a State Department document where his mother goes into the State Department and says, "My son is in the Soviet Union. I'm worried that I haven't heard from him. I think he might be a U.S. agent being sent there. And frankly, I'm destitute and I need compensation. I need money." And the State Department official responds, "Well, there's no evidence that he's an agent of ours, but we'll try and get the message to him that he should write to his mother, and we'll do that for you."
Right. So this 192-page dossier that was sort of featured prominently at this hearing, I read through it, and most of it is, I mean, there's newspaper clippings about Oswald defecting to the Soviet Union. There's State Department cables about Oswald coming into the embassy in Moscow initially, and then also trying to get his passport back when he's returning. There's FBI reports on his arrest in New Orleans, and when he gets into a scuffle with anti-Castro Cubans, all of which were routinely copied to both the CIA and the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and I think the Department of Navy, because Oswald was a former Marine. But they don't show, other than that one letter from Oswald's mother, surveillance of Oswald himself. Correct, Fred?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't under surveillance, but he was, you know, Morley seems to be bewildered. Why are all these documents in the hands of the CIA before the assassination? Well, if you go to the Soviet and Cuban embassies in Mexico City at the height of the Cold War, guess what? Your name is you're going to be in a CIA file. If you defect to the Soviet Union, you're going to be in a CIA file. So Oswald was always brushing up against American intelligence, but he wasn't under constant surveillance, as Morley seems to want to imply.
Except for when he was in Mexico, and then there was some surveillance. And that,
but I think Fred's point, Peter, is that the surveillance wasn't of Oswald per se; it was of the embassies,
exactly
the Soviet and Cuban embassies.
That's correct. Yes,
right. And Oswald comes in, so he gets picked up in the surveillance. Now, Morley in his testimony, I should point out, I've known Jeff Morley for years. I've been friendly with him. He's a nice guy. He's a diligent researcher, and has written multiple books on U.S. intelligence activities that had a lot of useful insights. I do think on this one issue about which he is obsessed, he is completely off his rocker. And I think I've told him in perhaps not so many words about that directly. But he says, well, the dossier may not be a smoking gun, he tells the committee, but the tipping point for him was James Jesus Angleton, chief of CIA counterintelligence for years, lying to the House Assassination Committee in 1978 about the mail order program. And Oswald being a target of the mail order program. So, first of all, the mail order program is not new, correct? We've known about that since when?
Since the Church Committee in the 1970s, they published a very, very detailed report about H.T. Lingual.
Right. So the fact of that the CIA was opening the mail of people it suspected of whatever was something that was going on for years. The Oswald, it looked to me in reading over the file that actually Oswald was just one of four defectors who were being subject to this program. correct. Did Angleton lie about the program to the House Assassinations Committee? And does that therefore reveal the fact that he lied, complicity in something?
I don't think he lied. If you actually go back to the testimony, they were actually asking Angleton what he thought of a notation, a card that was in Oswald's 201 file. Basically, it was it had a reference to H.C. Lingual and had a reference to the translator of documents. And so they were asking Angleton to explain what is this notation. And he was explaining it. It's H.T. Lingual. It's the mail intercept program. R.E. was the initials of the translator. The HSCA knew that was Reuben Efron, and they asked him about Reuben Efron. So they knew that. Now, to Morley, because Oswald was the subject or was part of H.T. Lingual, to him that indicates, oh, my God, he was part of a counterintelligence operation, which is not true. He wasn't part of a counterintelligence operation. He was just one person on the H.G. Lingual list. So he thinks that the next question that Angleton was asked was Oswald ever the subject of a counterintelligence operation? And Angleton says no. So he's not lying. It's just that Morley's misinterpreting what it means to be part of H.G. Lingual.
Right. And you mentioned 201 file. What's a 201 file?
It's a file that the CIA opens on an individual. It could be a file of newspaper clippings. Once they have an interest in you, they generally open a 201 file.
Right. Now, the other big witness before the committee was Oliver Stone. And, of course, he made that 1991 film that glorified the exploits of Jim Garrison, a crackpot prosecutor who claimed to have solved the case many years ago in the late 1960s, only to have his have it all fall apart in a New Orleans courtroom when the jury acquitted his chief defendant, the sole defendant, Clay Shaw, in what, less than an hour, I believe?
Less than an hour. It would have been even quicker, but the juries all had to pee.
Yeah. And what did you make of Oliver Stone being up there as a lead witness in this?
It was somewhat embarrassing. He really doesn't know the case, and so he can't really answer that many questions directly. And that's why he brought James DiEugenio, the screenwriter for his documentary series, with him, so that DiEugenio could answer detailed questions, because Stone just doesn't really know the case anymore.
Right.
Can I just say, for me, you know, Oliver Stone represented a degree of continuity and irony. He and the movie JFK, are solely responsible, in a sense, for the John F. Kennedy, you know, Assassinations Records Act. The grand conspiracy that he presented in the movie, coupled with a scroll at the very end of the movie saying there are still 5 million pages of documents that are secret about the Kennedy assassination, having just laid out a cockamamie conspiracy theory, a dangerous and cruel one as well. The other targeted person in New Orleans by Garrison committed suicide. So this continuity was very important. He's the reason why this all has happened, and conspiracy theories are the reason why this all has happened. But of course, the intent of Congress was to let everything out so that all these theories could be laid to rest. And instead, the opportunists, the people trying to weaponize this final declassification for political purposes, you know, call Stone back to continue to advance conspiracy theories instead of closing the door on them.
Yeah, I should point out that when you go back and you look at JFK, which is, you know, a very sophisticated and shrewd use of agitprop, other than glorifying, you know, Jim Garrison and his crazy conspiracy theories, the premise of the movie was that the motive that the CIA and the Pentagon and defense, the military industrial complex, all of which Stone presents as sort of complicit in the assassination, the motive was that Kennedy was about to get out of Vietnam. And the CIA couldn't have that. And the military industrial complex couldn't have that. Defense contractors couldn't have that. So they had to kill Kennedy to prevent him from going out, from leaving Vietnam. And one document that I have come across that's been out there for years, when I was at the LBJ Library a few years ago, they have on the wall in the museum, it's a great library with a great museum, they have on the wall the speech that Kennedy was going to give at the Trade Mart that day, November 22nd. Literally, his last words on the subject of Vietnam are in that speech. And I want to read you what Kennedy was preparing to say on November 22nd, 1963. About 70% of our military assistance goes to nine key countries located on or near the borders of the communist bloc. Nine countries confronted directly or indirectly with the threat of communist aggression. The first one he names, Vietnam, and then Free China, Korea, India, Pakistan, Thailand, Greece, Turkey, and Iran. No one of these countries, Kennedy was preparing to say that day, no one of these countries possesses on its own the resources to maintain the forces which our own chiefs of staff think needed in the common interest. Reducing our efforts to train, equip, and assist their armies can only encourage communist penetration and require in time the increased overseas deployment of American combat forces. This is said, was to be said in Texas, in November 1963, on the eve of an election year in which Barry Goldwater was very likely to be the Republican nominee. Fred, does that sound like the words of somebody who was preparing to get out of Vietnam?
No, absolutely not. I think JFK was extremely conflicted, but there's a great tape recording of a meeting with McNamara where they're talking about potential the opportunity to withdraw by 1965. It's all premised on the ability to train South Vietnamese troops, and they're talking about that training. And Kennedy says, "Well, you know, if they're not trained up in time, we could always move that date." And so everything was contingent upon the ability of the South Vietnamese to actually fight the war on their own. And of course, that was problematic in and of itself.
Peter, was Kennedy preparing to get out of Vietnam?
I'm not a historian of that particular era. I think most of the conspiracy theorists point to his American University speech in June of 1963. About, you know, peaceful coexistence with the Soviet Union. I don't know that speech went into any detail at all about Vietnam.
About Vietnam, yeah. I think as best we could say, Ben Barnes, who actually prepared Kennedy's trip to Dallas that day and helped lay it out, says the speech was a cowboy speech. And he was in Texas, and the idea that Kennedy would have done anything in 1964 when he was going to be running for re-election and leaving himself open to attacks from Goldwater and the right wing that he had lost Vietnam or abandoned it to the communists seems a bit far-fetched to me. One final point on conspiracy theories, and then I want to get to the documents that Peter would like to talk about that do shed light on other matters. Oswald got his job at the Texas School Book Depository in mid-October of 1963. Kennedy's plans, the parade route in Dallas wasn't finalized and publicized until early November, correct, Fred?
Even much later than that. Yeah, it was really publicized like a week, you know, a couple of days before. And of course, the actual, they were debating weeks before the arrival. They weren't really sure exactly where the motorcade would go.
Right. So has anybody ever figured out how the CIA could have used Oswald as a patsy, which is the claim of the conspiracy theorists. That's what Oswald himself called himself. He goes to work at a place where nobody has any idea that Kennedy will be driving by a few weeks later.
Well, not only that, when Oswald went to the interview for the Texas School Book Depository, there's two different warehouses that the TSBD had. So truly could have sent him to the other warehouse. It's just luck he chose the warehouse on Elm Street.
Yeah. And just my final point on this, and Fran, I do want to go to you on this. The conspiracy theory is, well, Oswald may have been shooting from the school book depository, but there were these other guys on the grassy knoll, right, who happened to be firing at exactly the same time. How did they communicate?
Well, it must have been through the umbrella man, you know, the man with the umbrella who was probably signaling with the umbrella. Or there were people with walkie-talkies. They had to use radios, signals to communicate. But it's all ludicrous. I mean, if you want Oswald as the patsy, why would you have shots fired from the front? Wouldn't all your shots be fired from behind to implicate Oswald? The whole thing doesn't make sense.
Yeah. All right. Listen, I think we'll leave it at that. The whole thing doesn't make sense. We're going to take a quick break and return to talk about some of the documents that have been released that are of interest to people like my friend Peter Kornbluh here and others who want to know the full history of the CIA during this period. So let's take a break. All right, we are back with Fred Lewin and Peter Kornbluh. Peter, you have contended that there are important revelations in these documents that have nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination itself, but do shed light on other matters. Tell us what they are and what struck you most significantly.
Yes, I'm very happy to emerge from the weeds of conspiracy theories to the actual historical facts of the universe of CIA and FBI covert operations, which we learned a lot about from the Kennedy papers and are continuing as we sift through these largely uncensored final releases of pages. We're learning a tremendous amount. We're learning the names of countries who the CIA collaborated with and the CIA targeted. We're learning the names of agents, frankly, that the CIA had all around the world. We are learning, and this is an incredibly entertaining for anybody who's kind of a quasi-student of CIA history. We are learning all the code names, which were censored before. MH Dozen, Wudor, which was the code name for breaking into the Chilean embassy in Washington in the early 1970s and setting up a whole secret wiretap and microphone listening system there to spy on Salvador Allende's Chile. You know, the incredible amount of
names. But wait a second. Salvador Allende's Chile comes years after the assassination. What, 1971?
Yeah, that's right.
The assassination was 1963. How are these documents from years after the assassination being released as part of the assassination file?
Well, one of the things that happened is that in the early 1990s, when the JFK Act was passed and the Assassinations Records Review Board was set up, the issue was is what they would define as an assassination-related document. And my organization, the National Security Archive, went in, met with the board. We pressed for the broadest possible definition, and others did too. And since there were all these swirling conspiracy theories, Cuba was involved, you know, the Russians did it, all of this, the board decided to take a very broad view of what such a record was. And there'd been these other investigations by the House Assassination Committee and the Church Committee of Covert Operations. And so they basically said, well, we want all those documents. And the universe of JFK-related material expanded exponentially to the universe of basically the history of covert operations in the 1950s and 1960s, and even into the 1970s. So a lot of the material of what the CIA was needed to give to the Church Committee, for example, in the mid-1970s, all the documentation about those communications and what the CIA would agree to give and what it didn't want to give, all of that is part of this release now. And so we really do have a kind of a very interesting universe of documents that any student of covert operations will want to consult.
Okay, one big document that has now been fully declassified is the Arthur Schlesinger memo after the Bay of, to Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, and this is a memo that's highly critical of the role that the CIA was playing, and suggested maybe that the. Well, tell us, Peter, what exactly did the Schlesinger memo say, and why is it important?
I mean, this one document is a great case study of what we've gained from this whole process. The document itself is 15 pages. It's titled CIA Reorganization. It was written by Schlesinger at the behest of the President of the United States, John Kennedy, who wanted to examine the option of reconstituting, reconfiguring, rebuilding the CIA, basically eliminating it as an institution, the one that had committed the disaster at the Bay of Pigs and deceived Kennedy about the prospects of success there, and bringing it more under control of the State Department or the White House, et cetera. And so this document was declassified more than 20 years ago, except for a page and a half. And in that page and a half, it dealt with what was called controlled American sources, that is CIA undercover agents working in embassies around the world. And that section was redacted. And, you know, the people like Jefferson Morley focused on this document because they, this document gives us the motivation that the CIA had to take down Kennedy. He was thinking about literally closing the door on the CIA as it was institutionalized at that time. And so we need the whole document. So a lot of people focused on this document, just the part that was still redacted. But the whole document is this incredible moment in time of CIA history in which the President of the United States literally did, for at least a millisecond, consider the idea of closing the CIA and reopening it and its functions in another way.
And it did show, I believe, that nearly half the political officers at the U.S. Embassy in Paris were actually undercover CIA officers.
You know, the movies in particular have left us the impression that the CIA is everywhere. But these documents reinforce that octopus tentacle-like reach that the agency had. It was omnipresent. Undercover in almost every significant embassy around the world, as Schlesinger pointed out in the censored part of his document, of his memo, you know, the amount of CIA agents undercover in embassies is almost the same amount as the actual legitimate diplomats in those embassies around the world.
If I can add something here, I mean, I actually found that document was given to the Church Committee in the 1970s. And in fact, George Lardner of the Washington Post published in 1975 a detailed article about controlled American sources, quoting from that document. It was known back then. And I was able to, you could see the redacted section, and you could see Lardner's article. You know, oh, I know where he got that from, because he actually quotes some numbers from the redacted section.
You're speaking to somebody who used to sit next to George Lardner at the Washington Post. Not quite as far back as 1975, but some years later. But what happened to the Schlesinger memo after it was sent to JFK? You know, the suggestion was that Kennedy wanted to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces, I think is the quote after the Bay of Pigs. But did Kennedy follow up, Fred?
Well, first off, that quote may not be true. Well, the most okay. You can say about the quote about splintering the CIA and scattering it to the winds is that an unnamed source told somebody the New York Times in 1966
That's correct.
That Kennedy had said that. There's no contemporaneous documentation to support that quotation. And of course, what happened was Kennedy moved some of the CIA operations into the Defense Department. And in fact, Robert Kennedy took over a lot of covert operations, and the Kennedys loved covert operations. And they did more of them than any other president. So he may not have been happy about the Bay of Pigs, but he certainly liked what the CIA and covert operations were capable of doing.
And they continued to work. The Kennedys, with Robert Kennedy taking the lead, continued to work with the CIA on Operation Mongoose to get rid of Castro. Correct, Peter?
Oh, they started Operation Mongoose after the Bay of Pigs, under the tutelage of Robert F. Kennedy, the Attorney General of the United States, assuming basically the position of, you know, Director of Covert Operations and overseeing the Special Group Augmented, the top elite, small group of men who supervised and decided on the most secret of covert operations around the world. And it was in that context that Operation Mongoose in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs was developed. It included much more than the CIA. The Pentagon was very heavily involved. And in fact, it was under Mongoose was run by a lieutenant general. So, you know, the covert operations continued, and Kennedy had an inclination for a moment and the opportunity in the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs to try and emulate the British model of control over the intelligence community and covert operations. But he went ahead and tinkered with this and that. He forced, you know, Alan Dulles into retirement. He fired Richard Bissell, the deputy director for plans, holding them both responsible for the Bay of Pigs disaster. He appointed his brother, as Fred has pointed out, to run covert operations. So he seized more control of covert operations, but he didn't change institutionally the CIA.
Right. And the efforts to assassinate Castro continued, correct? In fact, on the day of the assassination itself, there was a meeting in Paris between a CIA officer. I'm a little rusty, Fred. Perhaps you can...
That's Amlash. Oh, that was Amlash, Rolando Cubella, who was going to... they were giving him stuff to kill Castro.
Right.
Yeah, that right on that day. And he wanted signs from that. This was all approved by Robert Kennedy, which they gave him. Right.
So the idea that Kennedy was shutting down the CIA and shutting down some of these extreme covert actions ops doesn't seem to be borne out by the historical record. You know, look, we know that the CIA actually had been trying to kill Castro for some years, starting in the late Eisenhower administration days under Alan Dulles. And it always struck a lot of people, Peter, that if anybody had the motive to go after Kennedy, it would have been Castro, who knew that the Kennedys were trying to kill him.
Well, that was one of the conspiracy theories that was spun pretty quickly, that Castro was behind this. And most people don't know that at the very moment Kennedy was killed, Castro was meeting with an emissary that Kennedy had sent to kind of offer an olive branch for a peaceful coexistence between Cuba and the United States. That Kennedy, and this was the third emissary that Kennedy had used over the last year from between 62 and 63 in the aftermath of the missile crisis. But you know, I would slightly dispute your timetable. You know, the first CIA plot to kill a Castro, which we know about, is actually directed at Raul Castro in July of 1960. And then the plots to kill Fidel really started in earnest with the planning of the Bay of Pigs. It was supposed to be a parallel operation that would decapitate the Cuban Revolution right at the time that the invasion was coming. And that's when the CIA contracted with the mafia to start those
phases. But that would have been late 1960, correct?
It would have been, yes, it was in the fall of late 1960.
Yeah, so late Eisenhower administration, you know, but certainly continued under Kennedy. You know, one sort of, just to wrap up here, one thing that kind of struck me about all this is The claims about CIA involvement in the assassination was an idea that was embraced for many years by the left in the United States. And actually, I should point out, was also fed by the KGB, which helped finance Mark Lane and also, financced the book early on, Oswald, assassin or fall guy that laid out the case for that he was a CIA, FBI provocateur. So it was largely on the left that the Kennedy conspiracy theories flourished. Here we are, decades later, and it's a right-wing Florida Republican who's presiding, championing these documents released by Donald Trump as evidence of conspiracy. I mean, like, we've come full circle here. How do you to explain this, and what does it mean for our politics?
Well, I've always said,
here we are.
The JFK assassination is the Rosetta Stone of conspiracy theories because you could use it for whatever you want to prove. If you're on the left, you don't like the military-industrial complex, hey, the JFK assassination will explain it. If you're on the right, particularly these days, if you don't like the deep state, well, we could blame it on the JFK assassination. So you could use this for whatever you want. If you don't like Lyndon Johnson, like Roger Stone could write a book. Okay, Lyndon Johnson killed JFK. So it's a beautiful conspiracy theory that can be used by the right or left in the past, and I think the right now has realized, hey, this could be a lot of fun for us too.
Yeah, you did remind me of my favorite moment from the hearing when Congresswoman Boebert asks Oliver Stone if he had written a book saying that LBJ had killed Kennedy, and in fact she was thinking of Roger Stone, a different Stone. Peter, final word on where we are in our politics. Yes,
yeah.
Please.
I mean, watching the hearing yesterday and thinking about this whole situation, the advocates of transparency and the right to know find themselves with very strange bedfellows suddenly with all these members of Trumplandia pushing for, massive declassification and talking about transparency and the American public's right and deserving right to know what their government is doing in their name, but without their knowledge. And of course, that's a way of attacking the deep state and the so-called deep state, making it seem like that's something separate from the U.S. government, but and from the White House. But the truth is that this is being weaponized to make Trump look good, make him look like he's the transparency president. And nothing could be further from the truth. And it's one of those alternative facts, as Ms. Conway used to say back in the first Trump administration. But in the end, because of the law, less because of Trump and more because of the law, we have these documents, almost all of them unredacted. We are learning about history. These documents go way back, but they remind us of what happens when democracy is not informed and when darkness and secrecy take over, and an almost autocratic kind of method of operation becomes the norm. And so they're quite lesson producing, and it's good that we are focusing on them again.
Well, on that positive note about an otherwise deranged hearing before the House, I want to thank you both for joining us on what turned out to be a really interesting and hopefully illuminating discussion. So thanks, guys. And until the next Kennedy release in another 60 years, we'll leave it at this.
Thank you very much.
See you then.
Thanks. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.